Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.
They hired me, and what I did, I animated, it was just a black blob with six legs in walking across the screen.
The giant.
But they took the live action of the soldiers in the trenches, and on cue, they jumped out and ran away. So then I animated Scooty going across the screen, and they superimposed it over this shot. So when the cootie showed up, they all went over over the hill. But the boys in the story department said, gee, Walter, don't show to the old man now because, gosh, you did this thing in a few days and he let you go and you might as well get something out of this job, you know? Hold it for a couple of weeks, you know? So I said, okay, held it. And we had it all processed. Senator came in the cutting room. You remember how to chew tobacco? Used to spit in that sand box that he had.
Cigars.
Yeah, cigars. He'd chew and spit into this thing all the time.
He wasn't even chewing tobacco?
No.
Just chewing cigars?
Yeah. Cigars. Unlit cigars.
If he stopped spitting, you know, he enjoyed it. When he's spitting, watch out, you know?
Yeah.
I think you had that in your book, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I had something.
Well, anyway, he looked at it and he flipped. And he liked it. And then I made several other animated shots after that. And I was there until they closed the studio in December, as they always did. You know, they'd lay everybody, you get a pink slip, and they'd lay you off. And I was the last one to be laid off of the group. I was only there about 3 months. And I worked in the story department with the writers there. And he called me in his office. He said, Walter, you're young, you're out new here. And I just didn't have the heart to lay you off with everybody else. So I'm telling you now personally, you're the last one I'm going to let go.
Boy, he did like it.
He did.
Yes. He wouldn't do that for his mother.
Well, Frank knew the old man so well.
He's an amazing guy.
No.
It's going to sound much better.
Leave it.
Because his microphone is sounding much better.
Well, if he gave you that letter, he really liked it.
Yeah, he was
fine. And he liked your work, and he wanted to keep you.
Yeah, and the only reason I was laid off, when he laid off everybody just about a couple of weeks before Christmas. And he used to do that in all the studios in those days.
Yes, they did, because they couldn't, and then they couldn't get any work out of it. Boy, they were bastards.
They still, a lot of studios still do that today.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do that.
Yeah,
well, don't the union regulations prevent them from actually firing you and then hiring you back?
Well, not as long as they're on the job.
And you know, years later, when Mr. Sennett had, he'd had problems and he wasn't producing anymore and he couldn't get any pictures to make. He had lost the studio out there in the valley. And I met him on the street several times. He used to live at the Christie Hotel. I met him on the street sometime. And one day I met him, I said, Mr. Sennett, how'd you like to come have lunch with me? He said, oh, I'd be delighted, Walter. And he, very nice. That was one of the last times I saw him.
What year was that?
That had to be in 19, before I went to Universal, that had to be in late 27.
That's the last time you saw him?
No, I saw him after that. I saw him 28 or 29 there when he was living in this hotel and he was making pictures anymore.
When that was before you were Universal?
Was all before I went to Universal.
No, he made some sound pictures.
He made some pictures. That's right, he went to the valley.
See, these guys here. Killed off. But I say these guys are in animation people. Killed off some very great stars. All the Paramount stars.
The whole two reel business.
The whole two reel business of Paramount humor. It was wonderful humor, and they were just really getting to be. They really know how to. Make those wonderful comedies. Laurel and Hardy and all of them.
Yeah.
Harry Langdon.
Harry Langdon. And And Senate was, you know, right on the top of his peak, you know, making stuff with all kinds of people. Then comes along this animation, and bingo. Off goes the two reel comedy, and just killed them all.
Well, that kind of happened around the time sound came in, didn't it? That the Mickey Mouse cartoons and all those things were so popular.
Yes, Mickey Mouse.
And then, meanwhile, the silent guys had trouble making the transition. Some of them.
Yes, they were. Now, what's going on? Tried to make the transition with a Senate. As a matter of fact, he started Bing Crosby, and so he was going to go in, but talk was not their stuff.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen some of those things he did.
Well, they're all sight gags in those days, you know, sight gags and slapstick comedy and
very fast. We didn't crank, right?
They didn't depend on titles. There was titles on the screen.
You had to tell it's it
like the
action.
Things you did for Braid.
That's right. Yeah,
you had to tell it in action.
He had to start going with dialogue gags, and he went way back to these old vaudeville gags because I saw some of these things. People just stand and talk for 5 minutes and tell these old jokes that were 20 years old and were 30.
Yeah.
And just.
Well, as you notice in Frank's book, he made Langdon. When Langdon started to produce on his own, he just fell apart, couldn't do it.
Oh, yeah. Well,
that was a personal thing with him. But this was a really ocean-wide thing of the whole business. When the animators came on, the pantomimers died.
Well, wasn't
who killed Clock Robin? Mickey Mouse.
Well, I think the reason for that was we could do broader gags than they did in the
cheaper.
And cheaper. Yeah.
You could knock a whole building down.
Well, imagine how much Chaplin got a week. You know, those guys got big money.
And
Keaton, people like that, they got big money.
Woody Woodpecker didn't draw that big a salary, did he?
No, gosh, we were just about eight.
Mr. Capper, did you see any of the films that Walter did for John Bray as an actor? Did you ever see those?
I showed you some of those, didn't I? The combination.
As a director,
with the cartoon.
Your feedback from Walter as an actor, I mean, he looked so much like Harold Lloyd at times.
You know, Bray's to say with me, he said, "You don't look like a comedian. We've got to make you look funny." So they put the glasses on me without any lenses in them, and they check the pants, and I play with the cartoon characters.
You did some that you didn't work with cartoon characters. You did some that were just straight reels, right?
Yeah, I made two or three two-reel comedies. But I'm not a comedian. I couldn't make it as a comedian.
You don't show any of those anymore, do you?
No. Bray has those.
Does he still have them?
Yeah, he still has those prints.
He still has those?
Mm-hmm. He must have
them. Oh, you never mentioned that before. He didn't mention that.
Oh, you saw the stills. I showed you the stills. A lot of stills. I made about three or four two-reel comedies out here. Bray produced them. He starred me in them.
Out here? You didn't
out here.
After
were made.
Leaving and
after
dying.
I left there. And I tell you, one of the directors on them was, I think of his name.
Weren't some of these guys kind of popular in the 20s? Felix the Cat and Out of the Inkwell, weren't they reasonably popular? Not as big as the...
Yeah, but they were silent. They weren't competition to the two-reelers. And the stories didn't have gags in them. They were just the straight-line stories. It wasn't until we start gag up the stories and make them real broad, a lot of slapstick comedy and pratfalls, that they really started to get the belly laughs and become funny.
Mickey Mouse. Up at the time Mickey Mouse came out, they were practically unknown. Some people were doing them, but they didn't have this humor this guy got out of
Yeah.
I saw it in the U.S. when he first showed it to me. And I went crazy with it, and I introduced him to Columbia, and Columbia made his first contract. But I thought it was the funniest goddamn thing I ever saw. I couldn't stop laughing. 4 minutes, about 4 minutes long.
Yeah.
And this guy hitting with his tail.
And everything in sync, too.
And everything in sync.
Yeah, the music. That kind of made it, didn't it?
Yes. Sound and music. And that started that you couldn't, you had to laugh.
Yeah.
That's what some of the Disney guys tell me, that cartoons would have just died if it hadn't been for music and color and
died.
Sound and all those things.
That's why I stopped producing cartoons in New York. You couldn't give them away. The exhibitors were paying 50 cents to run them, you know?
Yeah.
So that's why I came out here.
So I guess you guys didn't see the cartoons as a threat at all or anything like that in the 20s. Didn't see that coming.
Well, by that time I was making feature pictures.
Mm.
They weren't minutes of features because there were two repetitions. They took place at the show in each theater, big theater, a normal theater, right? A normal show was a newsreel, a two-reel comedy, a feature. That was just
not a cartoon?
Then the cartoons.
Then the cartoon took place in the two-reel comedy.
Mm. Well, now...
But it didn't hurt the feature.
The impression I had is that in the 20s, when you had these big guys like Buster Keaton or Harry Langdon doing a two-reel comedy, people would go to the show just to see the two-reel comedy. Be on the marquee, and
the big stars.
It was a big draw.
Big stars, and once in a while they'd make a feature.
Yeah.
I made two features with him.
Yeah, well, those are his best. Those are his best pictures.
Yeah, it was Strong Man, wasn't it?
Yeah,
Strong Man and Long Pants.
Yes, the comics were very popular. Keaton. But does them.
Well, Lloyd.
Their names are up there.
Laurel Hardy.
Lloyd made hundreds and hundreds of short pictures before he ever.
Lloyd, Laurel Hardy, Lloyd, Langdon. They were.
Ben Turpin.
Marquee. Yeah. They were Marquee and Ben and Max Sennett. Max Sennett, Bailey Beauties.
Just Max Sennett's name was a big draw in those days. Big name.
You were sure to get laughs. They were funny. If they weren't funny, they'd leave the studio.
You see, in those days,
these guys were very.
They used to preview two reels over and over at the theaters, and if where they didn't get the laughs, they'd bring it back and reshoot them, and they were very expensive to make.
Yeah.
They were made, for instance, the two reel. Pictures. I didn't make these two reels. I wrote 26 two reels for Max. And the only reason I know this is the cutter that was there. Later became a great friend of mine, although I knew him there, Hornbeck, probably the best cutter.
Oh yeah, George Hornbeck.
No, not George.
George.
He was head of the editing department for Universal for years and years and years.
William?
No, he was.
William Hornbeck?
William Hornbeck.
Yeah.
Bill Hornbeck.
You make the two real comedies. That
you knew you wrote 26 of them? Because he
made 26 two real comedies.
Yeah. Four or five of these two real comedies were written for it's what started landing off these two real comedies. And those things cost more. Those two real comedies that I didn't direct them, I wrote them. But those two real comedies cost more than the features I made at Columbia.
Isn't that amazing? Was that because of the price of the stars had a lot to do with it too, didn't it?
Yes, but just more.
Big production in them too.
More went into them. It took more time with them. I turned out half a dozen features for Columbia in 6 weeks each at a time. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks to write them, 2 weeks to shoot them, 2 weeks to finish them.
Oh, really? Would that be like American Madness and some of those?
No, not American Madness, but the early stuff. You know. Mm-hmm. Some of them were silent. So you know how much money was spent on those comedies. Those comedies are important. They were very important to. I suppose they got more money from the theater than some of the features.
Yeah. And didn't they have special writers that used to write gag titles to try to get a laugh on the titles too?
Yeah. Oh yes.
Yeah. There were specialists.
And you know, a gag man got big money. You know what? The dean of the gag man. What's his name? Everybody wanted him. He got up in the thousands a week. They were looked up to, boy, as real demons if you could come up with a gag.
And didn't have too much script. I used to see I worked at Hal Roach's a while too at the Left Senate. Leo McCary went there do the same thing, do some animated gags for them. And Leo McCary, I'd see him go out with a whole script on one sheet of paper, and shoot, he started it. And then the gag man, and then the gag
was ever written.
They threw gag, they didn't write anything. This was just notes. And they usually write out the gag. And then they figured the business, how to top the gag, see?
You seem to get a lot of enjoyment out of that. You probably get a lot more, depth from an actor doing it that way, I would think. Because the actor has to feel it. More than
yes,
act something from a script.
That wasn't so hard to write a gag in a script.
You can't write a gag.
Yeah, you can say, here he takes a big take up. Well, what the hell is that? I mean, you could give a director. The director really was the key to this whole thing. He's the one. He was the best gag man of all because he had.
He had to
perform.
Look,
you could
see it.
He had to perform it, or see that they got made. You can give him a little thing. The cat drank beer.
Okay, how's he going to drink the beer?
Well, all right. The guy will get 5 minutes out of that, you know.
Just milking a gag, yeah.
No, because he drinks beer, then he goes, plays on the piano, 3 o'clock in the morning, puts something over his head, and everything, you know, a drunken cat running around the house.
That's what we call milking a gag, getting everything you can out of it.
Just out of three words.
Yeah.
You get a whole 4 or 5 minute routine, and those were the guys that come up with just a few words that would give you a full routine.
Like remember that cartoon I forget the name of it, where Woody's trying to sleep and a beam of light was coming through a hole in the shade, Mm-hmm. Wrote the whole story is about he couldn't sleep, trying to get that shade, hold it down, and then it'd go up. And
ties it to the radiator.
Ties it to the radiator. And, took, yeah, and radiator, it took the radiator up
the radiator,
in the air, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's very broad humor, very broad.
Yeah. Cuckoo bird.
Cuckoo bird, that was it.
But one thing would lead you to another, and then, of course, the big thing was the topper. The topper you had to have.
I'll tell you one thing about the two-wheelers, though. I didn't know what a gag was until I came out here. I used to make hundreds of cartoons back east, but I didn't know what was a gag. These are what I call the birds and bees stories. Nice, cute little fairy tale. We learned about gags from the two-wheelers. That goes for Disney and all of us. We never knew what a pratfall to be.
Yeah.
So we really got an awful lot from the two real directors and producers and actors. That's how we learned how to put slapstick comedy into the cartoons. We never did it before.
There was a lot of inspiration in there, because I noticed such very similar bits. One of them, you got Woody sleeping in the arms of a statue, just like Chaplin at the beginning of City Lights.
Yeah.
And remember Chaplin at City Lights? Yeah. Unveil a statue and he's in there. He started off one
and
of
doesn't the
Woody,
aroma from a
Woody
barbecue come to him and go in his
it.
Nose and he leaves the thing and he floats.
And he's floating on the...
Well, that's a broad gag.
Yeah.
If I had him come down and walk over there, it wouldn't be funny.
Yeah.
See?
What a thing that was to have that experience of... First of all, spreading a gag and playing it out and getting more or less the same. And thinking up gags was a tremendous experience. That I when sound came in, I brought that experience with me.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people didn't have that experience.
Remember the sequence
so,
that you had?
I had a great head start on these things.
You told me the story, this wonderful experience you had when you were doing this picture and you were in the gymnasium there and you found out that there was a swimming pool under the floor.
Yeah.
And that opened Frank. He got more business out of that routine.
Well,
they all fell in the swimming pool. You know?
That's
see that.
That was the first scene I shot way late. They were wonderful life. Have you seen my wonderful life?
Sure.
Well, the opening, in the opening sequence is the big pool. They all jump in the pool in that sequence. And I didn't know that pool was there. I was just shooting the scene. I was shooting a dance contest.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody came and says, "Hey, there's a swimming pool under this."
Under the floor.
Under the floor.
That opens up, you know.
I said, "What?" opens up. Jesus, I hear I had a bunch of kids, teachers and everything, dancing. Well, I really made up a little reason for it opening up. The guy got jealous.
So just kind of cooked that up while you were shooting it.
Well, first day of shooting.
Uh-huh. All the extras around and everything.
Yeah.
That goes back to our friend just telling you dream up. You work out a sequence while you're on the set. You have no more idea what you're going to do that morning when you walked out there. You know?
I certainly wouldn't think of that. I had other things planned, but I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But that... That came right out of the blue. You had to take it. But the minute I heard there was a pool there, you know, I said, you got to use it.
People falling with dresses.
This is the reason, really most of the biggest reason why I've been shouting one man, one film. He can get, I couldn't do this in a studio. I'd have to get permission from 40 stupid people up in the towers before you could do a thing like that.
Yeah.
It's gone. You wouldn't do it. But even if you thought of it, the process of going around to get changes in the neighborhood was just the hell of it.
That's what drove Orson Welles nuts, I'm told, too.
I wouldn't be surprised.
They get an idea, and they say, well, start filling out requisition forms and everything. You just reach into his pocket and say, just go get it. Go get what you need, and we'll shoot it, you know. I just didn't want to take the time.
Well, that's what ruined the business, too.
All the red tape.
See, I had complete carte blanche. I could do anything I wanted.
But what you understood, well, you understood character really well, not just gag, but how it relates to character. I saw Mr. Deeds not very long ago. I was really impressed, because Gary Cooper is not a clown. But you can get a lot of laughs from him if you really get into the character.
Yes, but basically, these films of mine have been successful because of the humor. They are comedies. Mm-hmm. They are also good stories about maybe some people. There's some places where you cry or something like that, but fundamentally they are comedies.
Which?
My films.
Yeah.
But that's what the entertainment part of it is, and that's what the audience is.
So I see that mosquito right above your head.
Mm-hmm. No. Right. Is there a mosquito in there?
Yeah.
I'll get it.
It's right up there.
Come on, fellow. This
doesn't like the off on Paul's hand. But,
you know, I know that you and Walter have known each other a long time. I don't think I've ever heard how the two of you met.
I think we met at Beck Shannon's. But as I say, not very, I knew he was there, and I knew he was doing these things, but I didn't get to work with him. You see, we, at Max Sennett's, the writers were at the top floor of a tower, four stage tower, mm-hmm. and each time you descended, you went by officials.
You look out that window, remember?
So you were really up there. We were called the prisoners of Eatondale. Four of a tower, mm-hmm. four-sided tower, windows out on four sides, and you were up there, and you went up there, and you punched the clock. You went up there at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, you came out at 6.
That's right.
And you didn't come down.
Remember, Frank,
because you had so many officials.
If you were late, Senator could see you coming up the road there. And he'd cut you off. You're 20 minutes late, buddy.
So he pretty much, Senator had a tower like we could look down and see everything.
Right at the front gate.
It was the biggest thing in the studio, it was this tower. He just overlooked over the whole thing. And you couldn't escape that tower. You went up there in the morning and you came down at noon. You went up at 1 o'clock and you came back at 6. So he wasn't in the tower. But I don't know where the hell you were. Do you work? I never saw you up there. I don't remember.
No, we're down below.
My question to Mr. Capper was how the two of you first met. And did you remember the day when the two of you first met?
It's hard to even remember. We had so many people around there. It was like a big factory there.
Well, how did the two of you become friends?
Well, number one, we're both Italians. And then we really got to know each other so much better up here,
later on, mm-hmm. as neighbors, putting all the work down below the hill, and coming up here and relating on a different level.
We spent a lot of time up here, and we're very close, and we enjoyed doing a lot of things together on the lake. Frank used to go out, took me on some wonderful trips here in his jeeps when I first came here. Explain this whole neighborhood to me and about Mono Lake. And
then I saw a great many of his Yeah, I saw more of his pictures up here than I ever saw in the theaters.
You still have your Jeep? You still driving around?
He has a one like we have.
Oh, yeah.
Last year, I had a rent six cartoons at the film festival at Mammoth Lakes here, and Frank introduced me and gave a wonderful introduction. But it was very, very funny.
Is that the one about how unlucky you
were? How unlucky I was. I was telling you, Ted, that speech would tell me how unlucky I was.
I'm trying to figure out what the hell I'm going to. I know I saved it because I hadn't finished it. I had a little thing to write for about her.
Yeah, I just wanted to. I wanted to use that. You know, I wanted to get a copy of that.
Oh, I know what I want to do with it. You know, if you know her for a while, she is Pippa Passes. You know the story of Pippa Passes? Mm-hmm. Brownies, sorry. Well, it's a wonderful story of a little slave girl that only gets one day of a year off. On that day is hers. And she does all, now she dresses up as wonderful as she can, and she comes up from her cellar where she's been working, doing all the dirty work, cooking, washing. And she starts out in the morning to walk the streets, and she sings as she walks. And people see her come, and everybody's troubles seem to fade when they see this wonderful little girl coming along, beautiful little girl singing and being so happy. Pippa passes, and she just left her little trail. She gave the little town they were ready to kill each other and everything else. She left them in peace again when she went. She didn't know she didn't know what she was doing. She was just so happy at being out in the sun, and everything she liked, every piece of every flower. She hadn't seen a flower in a year. and her joy, that freedom and ability to be out in nature for 1 month, for one day, just left us a trail of
She spread good vibes, and everyone picked up on her joyful feeling.
Without her knowing it. It's a cute story. That's what she is.
Yes, pretty
similar. She goes around, same thing. She goes on to everybody, talking to everybody.
Knows everybody.
Who's
Bee?
I felt that when I met her.
Okay,
Bee. She puts on her little hat and goes every call on anybody.
It's on the light over the table. See that? Everything's done for us. Frank, you and I are over here. You and I have a melted cheese sandwich. And we got shot with a gentleman that I caught for him yesterday.
Yeah. See, that's pretty good.
Mr. Campbell, would you like chicken rice soup? Or
soup?
Or a coleslaw?
She'll have me read it over and over at home to make sure it doesn't sound pedantic and it's natural, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's a fine relationship.
What does she tell you about how to handle interviews?
How to write your inflections and how to read a line. There's so many ways to read a line. Never read. I can't read naturally. I can't read from a paper and not sound like reading. I've got to do it off the cuff. I just can't. You have to be that. This guy can do it. I mean, he can look at the paper, throw it away, and go on for 4 hours.
I remember you mentioned that you had a director when you did your television show.
Jack Daniels.
Yeah, Jack Daniels. They would put you in awkward positions.
Oh,
you didn't feel natural.
You don't have to walk. Nothing worse than walking around the desk, sit down, cross your legs, and start talking. It was very old fashioned. I said, Jesus, Jack, I can't do this. Let me walk, let me sit down in a chair and do this naturally, mm-hmm. where I can use my hands. I just can't walk around and sit on the edge of a desk and start talking. I freeze up.
And he's better with people around him than he is alone.
I like that, more natural. But Gracie's got that.
Yeah.
She's.
But I think what his true character comes out when he's with people. Mm-hmm. You know.
Comes out in the boat out there.
Took them out in the boat around the lake.
That's right.
That was a treat.
That was tremendous.
He likes people.
And so is Gracie.
Sue him.
My friend, I've had 3 shows in Hawaii already. The last 2 shows, we had to go to the mayor's office. And Gina, now meeting a mayor, Walt would get so excited, you know. I walk up to the mayor, kiss her, and she puts a lay around my neck, and like I've known her, B was there, remember? B, the mayor, not her. B was way in the background. I said, B, come on up here, shake hands with the mayor. And she did, and met the mayor. That woman mayor there now. I want you to know that wasn't a man there. That wasn't a kiss.
Good thing you said that.
Yeah.
Of course, anything goes.
I don't want any coffee.
How about some tapioca, Mr. Captain?
I don't think so, dear. I think I've had too much. Thank you, dear.
You know what we're going to have Sunday night?
What are we going to have?
Clam pasta.
Oh, good.
Clam,
you
pasta.
Can make the
champagne
without the bean sprouts.
Well, they'd rather have the clam.
You think so?
Yeah.
Oh.
Is
that an Italian delight?
Yeah.
I understand, Mr. Carpenter, that you are interested in doing the forward in the book.
Well, he's asked me to.
Yeah, tell him what a stinker I am, huh?
I'd be very happy to. I'll try it.
The publisher would love it too.
And if it doesn't come off,
you're
welcome to get somebody else.
I'm sure it would come off really nicely.
No, I love it just because I'm so fond of Frank, and that I love to have him part of this of this book because he's one of the closest friends I have, and I like to just feel good about having a bit of Frank in that book. Really.
We can try doing it on tape if you want to do it that way.
I think better be writes it. No, let him write it.
You want to write it?
Yeah.
Takes me time.
Yeah. Okay. Frank likes it. You got to give me a copy of that speech. Remember the speech he made about me at the festival last year, B?
No, I don't think
that. Oh, you didn't go. That's right. You didn't go with it.
Probably some of that material.
He's the most unlucky guy, but he signs a contract for 54 years, you know. All the things everything was unlucky, then all the things I did because I was unlucky. It was a fabulous idea.
He's had quite a career, this guy, from nothing.
Well, 65 years now, Frank.
65 years.
There's nobody in the industry that's still active has been in as long as I have.
Since 1916?
16, when I started.
And what's more, he's a successful artist. He made money. He owns all his own product.
They're in the producer. Even Disney doesn't own these pictures anymore. They're public. They're in the cartoon producer in the industry that owns his own cartoons.
So he's a hell of a good businessman.
I understand you have a drawing of a
shooting the bear.
The bear through your window.
You
shot a bear right through your window.
That was very funny. Jeez, that was funny.
I didn't shoot. Didn't shoot. I thought I went through. Here's but knowing a little science to do. I thought he was picking up ours up and he was banging it up against the wall, trying to break this very thick trash box, and it was, and he ended up breaking it. And he beat the house with that towel. I woke up and went out there and raised the blind. There he is, and he looks at me like this. So I look at him, and he
like this, you know.
So then he goes back to the, you know, back to this.
Sure wasn't Walter in a costume?
No.
So I said, I think I'm not kill Barry right here, you know. So. And so I got my 22. And I thought if I could hit through the glass, and some of the glass will hit it with a splinter and get in his eyes, he'd probably turn and run.
He figured this out scientifically, you know.
So I shot right over his head. See? So he'd get some of the. I shot right through the screen. There's a hole in the screen. And he did take him, then ran up the hill a little ways. I said, maybe it worked. I went back to bed. Before I get in the cover, boom, he's out there. He's out there banging that damn thing. He finally opened it. And I went out there to see what the hell he was doing. I go, bears. You can't fool the bears when it comes to food, you know, they don't.
They smell it.
You know, and they smell you. They don't want any problems with you. You try to take some of the food away from them, you're in trouble.
Mm.
Bears are murderers, you know. They don't know their own strength.
I understand if you're trying to outrun a bear, it's best to run downhill. Is that right?
Because they tumble. Well, I don't know the room.
Well, it's best to run anyhow.
Yeah. Well, I understand they can run uphill really fast.
I would say the chin, uphill or downhill.
Don't worry. I think you'll run as fast uphill as you downhill. Bear up.
They had this big trap there, remember? They had a side of bacon in this trap, hoping the bear would go in. He takes the bacon and the door would come down. But see, this bear is smart. I think he went in and took the bacon.
We caught four bear. Right in our backyard.
Yeah,
but you have a drawing now from Walter.
Yeah, I made a drawing.
From the story.
Yes.
Huh?
Yes.
It would be interesting to see that drawing.
I got a couple of drawings I want to show. You know, I'm going to the, I told you that I'm going to judge the drawings and paintings of the safari hunters.
Oh, yeah.
And I had a couple here that I'm going to.
I'll tell you what, we can both find out.
No, you tell me.
Oh, I tell you.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay.
All right, I'll try my own.
She's really a good cook. You know? She doesn't stop. Just keeps coming out with this.
This area used to be used as a hideout for a lot of thieves or something. It's got the most nefarious names for things, you know. There's a devil's slide up here, and some of the names on this map, everything.
I understand there was gambling here.
Devil's this. And
this mountain.
Crooks, yeah.
There was a center of gambling in June Lake. Before the war, every Saturday, people come up at this, it's called June Lake Lodge. It's a rundown thing. Nobody can be in the way. But you couldn't get in unless you were in a tuxedo.
Mm-hmm. You had to have a tuxedo up here, right?
Pictures of a couple of these.
And they get wide open gap.
They're going to donate this one frame, they're going to donate that one. So Woody in the nest. And how to work the flag back in.
That's a beautiful shot to do. Try that eagle.
See that?
It really is.
And then I got, here's a drawing that I made. Woody as a old Red Cross nurse. It's just this little bird that fell out of the tree with a lump on his head.
Yeah.
By making that cute, you put a lump on the bird's head.
Mm-hmm.
See? You know he fell out of the tree.
It's the whole story.
Then this one here.
You don't want to tell the
story. This you'll like. This is from Hunter, see? the hunter's over here and they're shooting Woody's fan. He says, "Hey, knock it off, fellas. I'm not a duck, I'm a woodpecker."
That's a fun one.
Where is that? Didn't we see that at your place?
Yeah, you saw it at my studio. Now, they'll auction these off.
Mm-hmm. These three here?
The three of them, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the money goes to the Safari Club.
These are originals.
These are all originals, yeah. Now, these are things that nice. Walt never had the fun of doing, see?
No, never seen. No.
And I get a certain pleasure out of doing this thing that he just, well, he didn't have
it. In the art of Walt Disney, I don't think they have one drawing.
Not one drawing of his, in his book.
I don't think he didn't animate, did he?
Never, no.
Just a few things, not much. You know the reluctant dragon they have over my fireplace?
No.
He was supposed to have animated some scenes in that.
Well, I'll tell you one
reluctant thing. Dragon?
When his animators animated a scene, he looked at it and he didn't like it, he just dumped it. If it even cost $200,000, he jumped. Yep. Do it over. I couldn't do that. I had to save every foot I made. I couldn't afford it. I was working for Universal. Mm-hmm. You don't throw it in the
air. That's why you had no complaints from Universal. They were always happy.
Well, I've been with them. It's now my 53rd year, and I think the only reason is that it's making a darn good profit for them. Mm-hmm. They don't worry about a thing. I produce the picture, give it to them. They don't even look at it.
See, he had complete control of his own material.
Put it in a can, that it goes to New York. They don't even look at him in New York. They just send him out to the theaters.
That is most important. The most important thing is actually in making a film, I don't know if anything else, in making a film, there's so many million things that are not worked out beforehand, that have to be worked out while you're ongoing, that show their heads when they're, that you've got to be able to do something about at the time.
Right then and there.
Right then and there, yes or no. It doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter whether you say yes or no. Because 50% right, you know. Mm-hmm. If you say yes or no, you're 50% right. One. And 50% right is a hell of a score in show business.
Well, oh, brother. I'd say 25% right. I'd be very happy.
Yes. So if you've got guts enough, it takes guts to make pictures, that's all. Just pure guts and a belief in yourself that you can do it. And not too much worry if it doesn't come out. You know, you don't go and kill yourself. See, every failure is a step towards success.
Well, if I depended on Universal, there never would have been any Woody Woodpecker. When I sent them the first pictures, the head of the Shorts Company said, "Wally, you're on your cotton picking mind. This is a raucous, wild camera. He's ugly and everything. Don't make him." They'll never go. I said, "Look, I'm independent now, it's my nickel, and I'm taking the chance. So I made it on my own. I made them on my own money, I own them."
Maybe that's
and it went over.
The key to your longevity.
But if they were paying me a salary at the time, then there would have been anybody with
me. He couldn't have done it, see, that's and most successful things like that are done by one man, that's all. He's the key to the... In other words, the guy that makes the decision.
Yeah.
Can't have two cooks in the kitchen. That's what they...
Can't have two captains on a ship.
Well, another thing, Frank, having started at the bottom of this business, if an animator got in trouble on a scene, I could sit down in his place and draw it and show him what I had in mind. See? Because I animated for years and years. Same with yourself. You could get out there and play the scene for the person who was acting on the scene to show just what you wanted. Well, but Frank really did let actors have their head. He got such good people that they could feel what they were doing. They knew what they were going to do before they went on camera, didn't they, Frank?
Yeah, and in making a film, especially, so many things come up during the time that you're shooting. That I'd get the best possible script I could before I start.
Yeah.
But many, many times things came up, and you made changes, and it depends on not only on whether you've got an idea, but also on the actors. Some actors couldn't, you could see them stumble with a part they were playing. They weren't fit for the part. We didn't have a great choice of actors at Columbia, but like at MGM, they could give you anything you want in a way, with the whole gamut of actors. We had this, whom we could get. And sometimes we got people that couldn't particularly do that, or could feel them. Well, we read the damn thing for him. And most actors, the best thing we've got in Hollywood is actors. They are wonderful. They are really wonderful.
Don't you think there's some wonderful actors coming up in television too amongst the young people?
There are lots of them. And they don't get a chance to do anything.
No, they nice don't. And that's a good young director coming up.
That's lousy material, you know.
Yeah.
And a guy has to shoot the thing in 10 days, and no chance to. TV doesn't give its people. You can't tell what you got.
Another thing they're doing today that, gee, I don't know why they do it. They'll have a real dramatic scene, even at the end of a picture, and they play the music so damn loud you can't hear the dialogue. I was always a firm believer that you should feel the music if you had it behind a dialogue, but not hear it. Mm-hmm. Play up your music when you didn't have any dialogue, a chase or something like that, but don't blast that music out while people are talking. Isn't that right, Frank?
Well, that's exactly what it's for, to keep people talking.
That's right. Yeah, today maybe they want to drown out their talking.
That's
right. Yeah.
Well, television is just a hell of a problem for creative people.
Yeah. Yes. Excuse me.
They have to turn this stuff on so fast. I saw a Quincy picture the other night.
I heard.
And I'll be darned, after it was over, I said, Gracie, what the hell is it all about? I don't understand. And we sit here looking at it for an hour, and neither one of us knew what it was all about. It was just killing time to get sleepy, to go to bed.
There's a hell of a lot of talent going to waste in television. You'll get a chance to use it.
I love to see young people come along with talent, man, and so much of it.
You don't get a chance to use it to tell those stories. You don't get a chance to write it.
What do you think it starts with?
Writing, especially.
That's where it starts.
Oh, sure.
They don't get come up with the good stories. They knock out a story one a week and less than that.
Well, it's all committee stuff. I think that's what makes it murder.
Knock all the edges off, you know.
Mm-hmm. Everybody goes, well, I don't know about this.
I saw it last week. The ones were, whatever I saw last week, that's what they like.
Frank, you knew Gregory LaCava.
Yeah.
Well, when I first started in the business, Gregory LaCava was assigned by William Randolph Hearst, to set up the cartoon studio there on 125th Street and 2nd Avenue. And LaCava was the first man to create the storyboard.
Yeah.
He made the first story for our cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
Before that was all, we don't talk the story over then start animating, didn't even write it out. But he got a formula for cartoons, and that was a storyboard which is being used today for features.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he'd make a hell of a story.
Now, he was a good comedy director, wasn't he?
Oh, yes.
Very fun. He started as a cartoon animator.
Let's hear about LaCava. Mm-hmm. How did you know him?
Oh, it's I know him, for Christ's sake, I know him because that duck boot more blows than that guy. When he's drunk, it hits you.
Oh, drunk, it hits his best friend,
Really?
Oh, boy. And he's such a lovable guy. God.
But he was the first guy that I know of, I don't count myself on this, you know, having complete control of your film, because I had to get complete control of my film on Poverty Row, where it didn't mean a hell of a lot, you know what I mean? Yeah, you want to complete, fine. They'd fire you in a minute if your pictures weren't any good, you know. But Le Cava insisted on trying to have get control of his films at MGM, and people had, oh, Jesus, he had to have it down to start. And he worked at it. The films that he did make and could make are wonderful.
My man Godfrey, remember that one?
My Man Godfrey.
A great picture.
It's a six million. He made one
not the staircase. This woman was going around with a cat around her neck all the time.
Arsenic and Old Lace?
No, Frank made Arsenic and Old Lace.
Maybe one with Catherine Hepburn.
Le Cava's funny. He's funny as an animator.
You know, Arsenic and Old Lace, you know, I'm 28 years old now, and I must have been a kid when I saw that in the theater, but it really made an impression on me as a kid. I love that.
Yeah, kids love it.
You think, really? Do you get kids that response from people my age, that they remember it as a child?
Oh, yes. You can't show to it, you know, they can't get tired of it.
I can't. I would love to see it again.
They laugh just as loud the second time. All of my kids and grandkids, you know, they have films. They show for their friends. They show them this, and they all howl.
When did you first meet Le Cava?
Well, I met Le Cava. You know about me, but yes. Frank met Le Cava when Le Cava came out here. Le Cava came out here to direct Richard Dix, the Western.
Richard Dix.
He did, two featurettes with him, uh-huh. Western. Then he got into features, and he really hit it when he made My Man Godfrey.
Yeah.
That was the first big picture.
I got to know him because he lived down in Malibu.
Yeah. Well, he had a home down there in Malibu where Frank lived. That's
and I got very friendly with him. He was a very interesting guy.
Likeable person.
Also, he was best friend of
W.C. Fields.
W.C. Fields.
Yeah.
They're the only two guys that get... He's the only guy that get along with W.C. Fields. And to see those two guys play ping pong.
Ping pong?
Yeah.
Well, W.C. Fields was an accomplished juggler and could have
He could do anything.
Yeah.
And he'd say, with every blow, there was a name calling. Jesus, the thought of the most awful names is that they call each other. they get drunk together. They both had a bit of liquor.
Yeah. And you know, Le Cava didn't know how to drink. He started drinking out here. He never drank back east, but he got out here with the crowd with Barry Moore and that whole gang. You know, they were. And they just
hit it bad drink.
So it sounds like the two of you knew it. Each of you knew a different side of Le Cava. Yeah. You knew the early Le Cava.
I knew the early side. I didn't get to see too much of Le Cava when he got out here.
I went to the bat for him once when I was duck shooting with the guy was running MGM, and I said to him, why the hell don't you take advantage of this guy's Le Cava? He's a genius. He can make it a hell of a picture. He says, yeah, but for Christ's sake, he won't take orders. He won't do the. You can't make budgets. You can't tell.
No.
You can't. He won't take on a schedule. How can we work as a studio unless we have actors? So we allow them. 3 weeks to this thing, then they're going to be 3 weeks in there. You know, he'd like to have, he wants 6 weeks. He throws the machinery all out of gear.
He never would have a budget,
which you naturally would. There's no doubt about it would. An organization that runs on that kind of a thing.
Schedules and budgets.
Schedules and budgets. You can't give a guy, you know. I said, well, what the hell are you? Take a chance on that. What can you lose? You know, what do you lose? You get, you may get a great picture of him, but it'd be worth it. All of your fucking things that you're making, you know, over a day, over a year. One great picture is worth everything you make in a year. It is.
Yeah.
One great picture is seldom. Seldom. How many great pictures are there?
But Culver was the kind of guy like you and McCary, just kind of.
That,
you
know, they're all that same school, there, yeah.
Not worrying about the script or the budget, and bringing them, just making a good picture and making it live with the actors. And the actors contribute, right?
And I think that's why La Culver fell up out of the business, because they couldn't afford him anymore. He would not make a budget or a script.
And he's, a script. Yes, that's right. And he drank himself to
death. Yeah. Funny, when
full of this, still flying that flag.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, he couldn't do anything else. You know, he couldn't do anything else. He couldn't take orders.
La Culver was working on the World as a newspaper cartoonist. And then he went to work for Van Buren. That was making Mutt and Jeff animated cartoons. That's where La Culver learned how to animate. Then when Hearst wanted to set up his own cartoon department, mostly to publicize and make pictures about the characters in the newspapers, bringing up Father, Maud the Mule, Happy Hooligan, Jerry on the Job, Crazy Cat, all of those. We didn't create any new characters, so we put La Culver in charge. And I was working as an office boy for Hearst down in Bleecker Street there, and I was getting $7 a week there. So the editor, the Sunday editor, Morrill Goddard, gave me a note to La Culver to give me a job there, because he said, you'll never get anywhere in this studio with these artists until they die, you know. All I used to do was wash their brushes. So I went to La Culver, and he didn't know what to do with me. So he had a note that he had to give me a job. So he put me on camera.
Mm-hmm.
And the camera, no data, funny, Frank. We had the camera up here on the stand. Down here, you put your drawings. We had no motors, you know, to run the camera. You had a crank here. You say, two exposures, turn it twice. Give one exposure, turn it once, see? Well, anyway, so Frank, he gave me $10 a week, and then I brought my father, who was an invalid, my two brothers to New York, when I was getting about $70 a week. And then I didn't have enough money to furnish an apartment in New York, up in the Bronx, and La Culver gave me the money to furnish his apartment, so I could bring my crippled father and my two brothers to New York. And that's why I was great admiration for him. But he never would take the money that he gave me for the apartment, and he really was responsible for giving me the start. He's the one that taught me how to animate.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Hearst closed down the department, all the boys went to war, and I was too young to go to war. I was only 18 or 19 years old. La Culver was animating Silk Hat Harry and, you know, Tad's characters, and I was assistant to La Culver doing his in-between.
Mm-hmm.
And Stallings, George Stallings, was doing Jerry on the Job. And Stallings would get drunk all the time. I had to go and pull him out of speakeasies, and Bray let him go and gave me the job of doing the Jerry's on the Job, and that's when I became a full-fledged animator and just animate the whole picture, which was only about 250 feet long. And I attribute all that La Culver had given me that start. If he hadn't given me that start, I wouldn't be here today.
So he had a good understanding of people and what they could do. And
most lovable guy you want to be.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you knew that side of him too.
Oh, yeah.
Years later, that he still was a really caring individual and sensitive. And
oh, yes, very sensitive.
But he
very caring, and also very He was an artist. He was an artist. And he thought as an artist. And he objected to people telling him. He just simply objected to people telling him what the hell to do and when to do it. And
how to paint his
how to paint, yeah, yeah. And he wanted to be left alone. He just wanted to be left alone.
He was a good cartoonist. Very good.
He was a good anything he designed.
Good artist.
And that's what wrecked him.
When you knew him, was he still doing work? I mean, did he do work like Walter does here?
Yeah, I know when he was making films.
Frank made him when he's doing features.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he just went down grade. Doggone, as Frank said, the studios just couldn't take him anymore. It's too much of a risk.
Mm-hmm. Too much of a risk.
On account of drinking only.
Like My Man Godfrey is a real low budget picture.
Just well, that was his first one, he really.
Yeah.
And he wrote that story.
Yeah, he just could.
Good writer.
Couldn't take. He didn't want anybody around him, man. He didn't want any scripts. He didn't want any scripts at all. And say, how the hell can we run a studio and not make a script and find out how long this guy's going to work and this, who's going to work at it, who's going to... And he said, let me do it. For Christ's sake, let me, you know, keep your hands off. I'll make you the goddamn picture. Well, that was okay. I could get away with it because I was working 5 years ago. I was doing just everything with my... Every decision was mine, but that wasn't as a great factory where everything was running by
clockwork.
Well, but now everything is at the end of every day, the studio wants to know where you are, how much money you spent.
Yes.
What are we going to start tomorrow morning? You know, the assistant directors have to plan what people are going to have and where to expect.
Oh, yeah.
I never could understand MGM. I tried four times to make a picture there. I never got to first base. I got kicked out before the picture ever started in the end.
You were there very briefly in the 30s on that
mm-hmm.
Keaton thing?
Yeah.
Farther Bedroom or Bath?
Yeah, I was in there. And I wanted to be with those big shots. You know, they were getting got a lot of money and everything else. The directors down there got $10,000 a week, except nobody knew them because they never put their names on them. But on the desk of Mannix was a general manager, a tough Irishman. On his desk there was a sign: "The only star at MGM is Leo the Lion."
Oh, no. Oh, I didn't know that. How do you like that?
That's what you read when you first came in, you think.
Yeah.
Put you down quick. Go ahead.
Well, you did it in spite of all these obstacles. Frank had his obstacles. You've got to have a lot of obstacles to become successful. It doesn't come easy, does it, Frank?
I was not quite as... LaCava and I were quite a bit alike, except he could not accept. He couldn't cope with opposition.
Couldn't be regimented. In other words, no.
He couldn't beat him.
I don't know how you can make a picture if you can't cope with opposition.
Now, I had a deal with Harry Cohn. It wasn't a good deal. I didn't give a damn how much he paid me. I never cared.
Mm-hmm.
I never cared about money. I knew that would come later, if either I was successful or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't worry about how much you get for a stinking little thing. I said, I want to do everything. I had never, you know, I never made a feature, but I wanted to write it, direct it, edit it, put the music in it, everything, put it in the can and ship it. I want to do all those things. And he says, what's left for me to do, for Christ's sake? I'm running this place. I said, you have the greatest power of all. You can fire me. What the hell is that? If you didn't like it, you fired me. So under those conditions, now it's funny. At many times, he's a very curious man. Nobody's written up Harry Cohen really right.
You're one of the few people
who
do.
Very complex character. Yeah. Very complex.
You wrote something about him in your book. Gave a pretty good idea of his character.
Because that's something I remember. You know, if he could beat you down, he didn't want you. Mm. He didn't care if you were the biggest star in the world. He didn't care if you were known as the greatest dramatist. If he could beat you down, he didn't want you around.
And if he tried to beat you down and he couldn't, then he'd have all the respect in the world.
And he'd have
that's
respect.
That's where Frank could tell him off. See, he wouldn't take it.
That he'd take it. Now, in all the time, I really found out early that this is what this guy was, and I'd been around a bit. I had been around the world a little bit, so I'm pretty worldly. I'd sold so much lousy, bad stock that I knew. If we got into an argument and there was a decision to make, I had to win the argument, no matter what. If I ever lost once, to him, I'd go down and see my his confidence. Mm-hmm. Now, there were some very funny situations that would arise out of that. At times, I argued and I knew I was wrong. He knew I was wrong. He also knew that I knew I was wrong. Now, what are you waiting for to see me get out?
I could squirm out of it, huh?
Jeez.
Now, I come this way, bring up this, and finally I'd get out of it. I'm his man.
That's why you made the best pictures I ever made.
I'm his man.
That's still living. That's,
as long as, see, as long as you aren't afraid of him, you can beat him down anytime. He loved that.
You know, one thing about Frank I admire so much, he's shown me so many of his pictures. Every once in a while we get down to his house and run a picture. And he can laugh at his pictures like he did at the preview. He enjoys it like he's just seen it for the first time.
He said,
that's funny, Wally. Look at that. Not because he did it, but he gets such a bang out of it every time. You know? He's only seen the picture probably 50 times. See? Well, that's wonderful. Everybody should feel about that, everything they do. I enjoy looking at a painting that I made. I look at a painting and say, gee, did I make that? I don't know how the hell I ever made that painting. Where did it come from?
It's like that picture of you laughing at your own comment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He says, I had a great picture, and it couldn't have been a posed laugh. It had to have been really laughing.
Yeah, he's really having a good time.
You've got to enjoy what you're doing, really. And it's not ego either. It's just that you love what you're doing. You feel good about it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You feel good. And lucky is the guy that has work that he loves. You know.
Oh, boy. That's
why you say so lucky that.
That's why I tell everybody, Jesus, don't ever give up.
Whatever their work is.
Even Frank, he's working now on a novel. Now, this is all fiction. He's been working on He's working on the last 3 or 4 years, really? but something for him to do.
But I'm learning. I'm learning to write. When I was going to school, I was the only kid in my whole family that went to school, but I went to school against all kinds of opposition. But I had to contribute my share to the house. Studies came easily for me, like that. Very easily. Mathematics, no. Science, almost win the top prize. I never had to, no homework. Physics, terrific. Loved physics. One thing that I thought I could do away with and give me more time to make some money on the outside was English. All these hard subjects I took. Mm-hmm. But English, I thought, was the one I would need the least. And so I could do away with it. So grammar, and all that business of grammar from the kid on up to, I missed all that. I missed a whole thing, and then I learned by myself later on, poetry and stuff. I didn't know it. I thought poetry was for rich little bastards. I was at that time. So, English. So now I discovered English. A little late, but it's there.
You also had a lot of exposure just, at the finest.
Just arrests. Last year, Frank said to me, I think I'm going to take a course in English. I want to learn. This was just last year. But that's what's so wonderful, that you can, that you still want to do things, create things. That's
yeah.
That's I still admire anybody that can write. Anybody that can write. Good writers are good. They got to be good. If you aren't a good writer, a bad writer, you're not much.
You got to have the use of words today, and you got to write well.
Yeah, and you have to know the difference between really putting a sentence over and just being a show off with it, being fancy.
Oh, be God, yeah.
Fancy. It's just got to be nice,
Solomonizing it. I mean,
and sound easy. Huh?
Now,
Solomonizing it.
Solomonizing.
I got away with my biography because I knew all about it. You know, I knew myself. I just talked it really.
Mm-hmm.
His biography is like we're talking now.
Yeah, but
he talked about everything he did in his life. And when you sit down with a blank paper and you write fiction, now that's a new ball game.
Yeah,
that's a new ball. No, so I'm sorry. Now I've rewritten this thing three times. I've improved it each time.
Can you give us a clue what it's about?
It's this country. It's later in this country. The problem I have is that I have a hell of a story to tell, but I'm telling it in a beautiful place, and I don't know I give too much prominence to the place, to the beauties, and the atmosphere, and at the expense of the story, or forget the place and stay with the story. It's a problem. But I don't give a damn.
It sounds as if you know you're not only telling a story, but you've set an atmosphere.
Yeah.
To where the person reading it can really get a feel, a placing of what where the story's at, where the story's.
Now, how much
can you do that?
Can you do that and still keep the story alive and the people alive? Because after all, the people are much more important than the atmosphere.
No, because Woody Woodpecker said, well, Frank, how would Hemingway do this, you see? That's what he said, Bobby. What do we say? Why don't you do like this? Wait, you want to take some pictures?
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm learning. My English is going to be my English is improving every day.
Have you ever read George Orwell's essay on clear writing? That's really about the best one I've ever seen. He picks up a lot of examples of people complicating the
situation.
Look what they got.
In fact, I read a couple of paragraphs this morning. That somebody was quoting Orwell and quoted these two paragraphs.
I'd like to see that.
Another book.
Oh, I've always got it.
That's a great piece. You read his stuff, and it seems very simple.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's very precise. Everything's in place.
Good.
Mr. Capper, can you foresee this turning into a movie?
Let's wait.
Yes, yeah.
Is that what you're thinking?
Oh, I could write a script on it. It's in a minute.
Yeah, wait a minute.
And then you could direct it.
No, I wouldn't try to.
The thing that got me about your autobiography is it starts out just like one of your films.
8, 7, 5.
It starts right out going. You already know the story.
Yes.
I mean, you know the conflict. You know what's going to happen. Right away. Couldn't get over that. That's the last, we were talking about it last night. Last time I saw Mr. Deeds, first thing that happens, guy's tearing along the road.
Yep.
Goes over the side of the road, boom. Jeez. The way that you could, you know, that's really the same thing.
Just right.
Telling
right.
a story, you just start right out.
You have to grab.
Set the stage.
You have to grab the people.
See, the things that do the community here now, every year they have a big art show. And it's the art show is only for the people that draw. They're all amateurs. Paint, draw, anything. Or they make macrame, they make furniture, everything. And I judge this show. So now she wanted to know if I was going to buy the ribbons again. And she said, sure, I'll buy the ribbons. I buy all the ribbons that they give to the winners, you see.
You have to go pick up your own ribbons?
No, they buy them. I just give them up, whatever the ribbons cost. And last year I bought a big banner that goes across the street. But they have a pretty good show, don't they, Frank?
Yeah.
You want to take a couple pictures out on the porch?
Sure. We can get maybe the three of you in a boat and I can take pictures from the dock.
We can sit down on the dock there.
The boat.
We can sit in. You can't go up and do too well with the boat. It sounds too rough. We can do them near the dock there. We can get in the boat and you can stand on the dock.
All right. We can get these professional fishermen in their environment.
Well, Frankie comes over for lunch. It's all these things aimed at him.
Why don't you look at this?
Here's my tape machine. This is my camera.
It's a 50mm. Want to use this one? Is that the other camera?
All right.
How long have you been running?
Yeah. But be sure and have
I started my Marx Brothers book in 67. It didn't come out until 73.
This should push halfway down.
I spent a few years doing it.
You don't take the black and white camera too?
And then a couple of years getting to put it out. So since then. And it's all.
When we get out there, you set it for a world.
I sent you a letter a couple of years ago about something I was doing.
Your name is very familiar.
It was that Astoria thing. You didn't want to talk about the army and the whole thing. The people back in Astoria wanted to do an interview with you about that army stuff. And you said, geez, don't bring that up. And I thought, if Frank Capper is that definite, he doesn't want to talk about it, leave it alone. So I didn't bring it up.
How long ago was that?
My glasses on the table.
It would have been 79 or 80. Uh-huh. Just recently, I wrote you a poem.
Here they are.
You got a very nice letter turning me down. It was a real nice letter, but it was real lesson. So I said, all right, okay, I'm not fooling around with that.
Well, it was at the time, I guess, we're just getting out of Vietnam and stuff like that. I think war is the most stupid, archaic, goddamn thing that man ever thought of.
Yeah.
Actually, war. It looks to me like a combination of all the old men getting together to kill the young ones.
Yeah.
You know? Kill them off for as. And so, and I've often wanted to do something cynical like that, you know. And when the old men get together, and these young guys are going to take their jobs pretty soon. They're going to be running the world pretty soon. And to keep themselves on in their jobs, they keep killing off the young kids through wars.
Yeah.
Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.